From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit after bankruptcy. The city is trying to get back on track, but some residents see business bypassing the neighborhoods.
To support their goals, their vision, and my vision didn't count, even though I'm the one that's here. Even though I'm the one that everything that they do affects, I don't like that.
And others wonder, with all the crime, can they really stay?
That I'm crazy for living here with my family. I wonder, what am I doing? I need to do something about it. I need to move before something happens.
And what about the city's schools? Schools still under emergency management.
The policymakers in our state owe us a coherent system in exchange for our willingness to tax ourselves to pay for that system.
The future of Detroit, but first, the news. From Michigan Radio, this is a special edition of Stateside with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, looking at Detroit and life after bankruptcy. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. The largest municipal bankruptcy in the country settled last month. Politicians declared a new beginning for the city of Detroit, a fresh start. Those declarations at the federal courthouse downtown were echoed in the news headlines, but they don't have the same resonance in the neighborhoods. Day-to-day life doesn't show any immediate signs of improving that much. Michigan Radio and its partners at the Detroit Journalism Cooperative have been keeping you up to date on the bankruptcy proceedings these past 18 months, but we're also spending a lot of time looking at the bigger picture. What do Detroit residents face after bankruptcy?
Well, there's a lot of changes.
We recently sat down with three generations of one family to try to learn what has changed for them. Yolanda People's perspective is that the municipal bankruptcy was needless.
Bankruptcy. There's no bankruptcy. It's just an opportunity to steal. Our city was having some financial issues, but not enough to declare bankruptcy.
Peoples lives in the Jefferson Chalmers neighborhood on the east side of Detroit. She's 47 years old and the mother of two children. She says filing for bankruptcy was a ploy by politicians, big money, and outsiders to take away assets from Detroit and its residents.
To support their goals, their vision. And my vision didn't count, even though I'm the one that's here. Even though I'm the one that everything that they do affects. I don't like that.
Across the living room, her parents and her children not in agreement. They're not alone. Among many Detroit residents, there's the sentiment that the governor and his emergency manager took or gave away too much of Detroit's assets. But that was not the narrative on the day of the bankruptcy settlement. The judge who mediated the settlement, the governor, the mayor, the president of the city council, and the outgoing emergency manager praised their own work and the work of those who supported them. The talk was about a new beginning. Detroit's most recent edition of a renaissance. Governor Rick Snyder, just a couple of days after his reelection, saw nothing but relentless positive action by the city and the state ahead.
If you look at downtown, midtown, the riverfront, truly exciting things. But we do need a continuing focus. We do need to redouble our efforts on the neighborhoods to make Detroit a place where people can raise their families, have their kids grow up, and have those kids want to raise their families right there and have a better and better quality of life.
At the city level, both Mayor Mike Duggan and City Council President Brenda Jones reinforced the idea that the work to turn around Detroit must extend beyond downtown, midtown, and the riverfront.
Most importantly, we must empower and employ the long-suffering people of Detroit.
But the long-suffering people of Detroit have lost a lot. They keep paying taxes, and they've kept losing city services. Yolanda Peoples remembers when her neighborhood was very different from the one her kids live in now.
The parks, when I was growing up here, we had concerts in the summers. The bookmobile, they used to come. There were so many different activities that we could do right here in our neighborhood that don't exist anymore. If you don't have a car, then that becomes an issue. It impacts you financially. It impacts you emotionally because your children want to do stuff. They want to be exposed. They want to learn.
But many families don't have those options. They're stuck in deteriorating neighborhoods where the crime rate is among the worst in the nation, where the bills for water are high, the bus service is erratic, many neighborhood schools are closed, and the streets are dark because the streetlight replacement effort hasn't reached many neighborhoods yet. And there are too many vacant homes as people move away. People says her old neighbors ask her why she doesn't move like they did. She rejects that idea.
There are not enough people like me who stay. If there were more people like me who stayed, we wouldn't have been in this situation to begin with. It would have been a different outcome.
She says too many people give up. Too many Detroiters feel the only choices are to move or just live with what the city deals them. She says too many residents of Detroit have been quiet for too long and that they've been too passive, allowed outsiders and the powerful to dictate the direction and the future of the city at the expense of those who live there. People says Detroit is its people, and the people are not speaking up.
They just want to go along and get along. They don't want to be viewed as a troublemaker. Because when people like me, poor minorities, speak out, speak up, we are considered as troublemakers. We're disobedient.
She says she's tired of watching the city give away control of its water system, Belle Isle Park, the Joe Louis Arena, the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel, and other city assets, which were part of the municipal bankruptcy agreement with its creditors or the state. What's left to serve Detroit citizens is precarious. Even with much of its debt wiped away, the city's budget could still be a house of cards. Many of its revenue sources are not stable. It's heavily dependent on a city income tax. If another economic dip is around the corner, that source of revenue would shrink. And then there is the property tax. The property tax rate in Detroit is a very high 3.3%, twice the median rate in the state. This summer, we talked to Tom Gutierrez. He's the executive director of the Grandmont Rosedale Development Corporation. It's a nonprofit that buys, restores, and then sells homes in the Detroit neighborhood. Gutierrez says although it's high, that property tax rate isn't really a deterrent to buyers right now.
It's somewhat offset by the fact that the values of the homes are lower than what you find in other places.
For example, the brick and limestone house we looked at.
Tudor-style home, three bedrooms, bath and a half. The home was a foreclosure. GRDC bought it. It was in not terrible shape, but, you know, it had been neglected. We thoroughly renovated the home and put it on the market. We had a lot of interest in the home and ended up with four offers, including the offer that we selected was more than what we were asking.
They were asking $130,000. Granite countertops, original refinished oak floors, sunroom, mature trees lining the street, and every house on the block just as nice or nicer. $130,000. As house prices start to go up, those tax bills will also go up. Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan knows that could discourage buyers. He says in some areas, though, homes have been overassessed. He's instructed the city to start adjusting assessments downward. Lower assessments will mean less money for the city in the short term, but it might attract more home buyers. And that could mean more people actually paying property taxes instead of walking away from homes. Almost half of the property owners are not paying real estate taxes in Detroit right now. Tom Gutierrez with the GRDC says the city has to figure out how to fix that.
We need to get some understanding of whether that's because they can't afford it or they're choosing not to in some cases. And this isn't just residents, this is businesses, this is big companies and small individual homeowners. So a big part of the problem in the city right now is the low tax collection rate.
The city is pressuring delinquent taxpayers and using creative ways to speed up the foreclosure process in some cases. But collecting what it's owed is still a major problem for Detroit. Detroit also took a financial hit in the loss of revenue sharing. Samantha Harkins is the director of state affairs with the Michigan Municipal League.
The state was taking money that was supposed to go to local units of government, and they were using that to fill their own budget holes. And so we went from revenue sharing to revenue stealing, essentially.
But Detroit has been hit three different ways. First, like all cities, the legislature cut revenue sharing. Second, part of revenue sharing is based on population, and Detroit's been losing people like crazy. About a quarter of its population has left in the last 10 years. And finally, Detroit made a deal with the state to lower the city income tax in exchange for more revenue sharing. A few years later, the state backed out on its part of the deal. Since 2003, the state has diverted more than $700 million away from Detroit. The state did increase the local government share a little last year and again this year, but it will be a long time before the state shares as much as it has in the past, if it ever does. An economist at Michigan State University says cities are at the mercy of the state. Eric Scorsone says he doesn't expect the state is going to let loose much of the revenue sharing it's grabbing now.
Given that we don't know where the state budget will go, I mean, if it continues to kind of creep up at this point, then I would expect the monies to go up a bit. But they're not going to recover from where they were, say, 10 years ago for quite a while yet.
Scorsone says with none of its revenue sources going up substantially, Detroit does need to find even more ways of being creative. It could privatize more services, or it could collaborate with the surrounding counties and cities as it did with the water system. And although resources will likely be flat, Detroit's expenses are expected to go up. That's because of its aging infrastructure. Even in the places where the city is seeing investment, the underpinnings of the city are weak. Recently, downtown's aging electrical grid failed. Buildings throughout downtown lost power. The city owns the distribution system. There is a plan for DTE to take over, but it's not clear the antiquated system will hold up until the transfer. Detroit's downtown could go dark again. Another example, the CompuWare World Headquarters building at Campus Martius, a recent purchase by billionaire CEO of Quicken Loans, Dan Gilbert. The building is a gleaming example of downtown revival. But earlier this year, just down the block, the facade of revival was peeled back for a moment. An old water pipe broke. A water main break is more than an inconvenience. For the businesses on Woodward near Campus Martius, it meant losing money. Tommy Chang is the manager of Bangkok Crossing Thai Restaurant.
Does this say much about the city's need to invest more in its old infrastructure?
Yes, it does. Yeah, because I mean, the city is kind of old and a lot of things is breaking down and need repair.
Now, every city has to repair water main breaks. But in Detroit, there are a lot of them. Some of them are hidden in abandoned buildings, water continuously running, causing the cost of water for residents to be much higher than necessary. And there are lots of other examples of neglected infrastructure. The Detroit Fire Department has to deal with all kinds of broken equipment in the city that puts out more fires than New York City, which has 10 times the population. The bankruptcy agreement does allow the city $1.7 billion in reinvestment over a 10-year period. That means there is some money to fix up the miles of aging water pipes, replacing old firehouses, and getting new squad cars for the police. But in the long term, can a city of fewer than 700,000 people pay to keep up the water pipes, sewer pipes, streets, and bridges built to serve more than 2 million people? It will take all the money the city can raise and collecting what it's owed if it's to make life better for the residents in the neighborhoods. Coming up later, we'll take a look at some of the services the city provides to its citizens and whether anything's getting better. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to a special edition of Stateside with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, looking at Detroit and life after bankruptcy. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. If Detroit's going to experience a renaissance of sorts, it first needs to keep the people still living in the city and attract more people. Sounds simple enough, but there are, at minimum, two major obstacles. First, crime. The crime rate actually fell last year, but not enough. Detroit is once again the big city with the highest murder rate and the highest violent crime rate. We'll look at how that affects residents and their willingness to stay a little later. But let's look at that second obstacle, the schools. Back at the home of Yolanda Peoples, we also talked to her daughter, Erin. She's 18 years old. Right now, she's holding down two jobs while also taking college classes. Her brother, Josh, is 11. Erin talked about the differences between when she went to Detroit Public Schools and what her brother is experiencing today just 7 years later. The neighborhood grade school is closed, and middle school is much different now.
It's like sixth grade. It started, you had separate classes. You had math, science, English, social studies, all separate. But now Josh goes there. Like, the sixth grade is just one big class, so a teacher has, like, all the sixth graders in one class, so it's like 40 kids that she has to teach by herself.
50.
Everybody in the room was surprised by that. 50 kids in a classroom. I asked Josh, what was that like?
We don't really have enough space to walk around. All the seats are, like, crumped together. And it's, like, really, really loud. So I can barely hear anything.
Spain is supposed to be one of Detroit Public Schools' better buildings. Josh says the pool where Aaron was on the swim team is now closed, and there's a shortage of teachers.
We don't have a band teacher anymore. We don't have a computers teacher anymore. And most of the electives aren't the same as Aaron's.
Fewer choices?
Yeah, fewer choices.
Josh and Aaron's grandmother, Gwendolyn Peoples, was a teacher in the Detroit public school system for 32 years. She says there's no reason the district had to close as many schools as it has or for the overcrowding that Josh lives with. She blames mismanagement at the top for the steady decline of the public schools.
We had money. We were always top heavy. You put a lot of people on top and one person on the bottom, everybody's going to fall. So had they cleared the top some, they had too many bosses.
The state of Michigan declared the Detroit public school system was in dire financial straits, and the first emergency manager was appointed in 2009. It was the first of a series of emergency managers put in place to run the district to this day.
Emergency managers were a waste of time, and they got so much money. They claim we didn't have money. How do you pay these people for doing a job that they didn't even resolve or solve?
The school district has continued to decay under the administrations of the emergency managers. Student outcomes have declined. The district is in continuing or worsening financial distress. Enrollment has declined. The school district does note there has been an increase in the high school graduation rate. Dan Varner is the head of Excellent Schools Detroit. That's a nonprofit group trying to find solutions to improve education for Detroit students. He says whether an emergency manager leads the public schools is not the main factor in the decline.
Perhaps the emergency manager has slowed the decay. I would argue that if we're choosing between that and the emergency manager hasn't worked at all, it doesn't much matter because the decay has continued is the bottom line.
Varner says part of the cause is spreading the student enrollment to charter schools and to the Education Achievement Authority, the EAA. That's meant the dollars that accompany students are spread more thinly across more schools.
Lifting the cap on charter schools and kind of creating a completely unregulated environment in Detroit led to kind of created the conditions that allowed for the expansion of the charter school sector in Detroit so dramatically and without any regard to quality, it's put pressure on every school, charter, DPS, and EAA around enrollment. That's been a net negative for every school system in Detroit, I would argue.
Varner says there are three major obstacles to better results for Detroit students. Number one, the state needs to determine how much it needs to invest to make schools work. Number two, the state and Detroit should figure out exactly how many schools the city actually needs. And number three, leaders in the state need to set up some definite goals to determine how to educate students and make sure the schools then measure up.
The policymakers in our state owe us a coherent system in exchange for our willingness to tax ourselves to pay for that system.
In the meantime, Detroit parents face a lot of confusing options. Many parents just move out of Detroit and into cities with better schools. Others want to stay. My colleague Sarah Swick met a couple earlier this year that faced some tough decisions and learned firsthand about those problems that Dan Varner outlined.
What's that? Tell me what that is.
A ballerina.
Dara and Jason Hill have owned a gorgeous home in Detroit's historic Indian Village for 15 years. For the most part, they love it here. And that hasn't changed since their daughter Nora was born 4 years ago. But they have developed new worries. Nora's parents are thinking a lot about school. They've been actively school shopping for more than a year. Both Hills grew up in Detroit. Dara attended public magnet schools that drew students from all over the city. And ideally, she'd like something similar for Nora.
I'd like her to have exposure to all kinds of kids from all walks of life.
It's not news that the Detroit public schools have severe long-term financial and academic problems. The big change over the past 15 years has been the explosion of charter schools in Detroit. So Detroit parents have lots of school choices, but they don't necessarily have lots of quality choices or even know what to look for. That's why the Hills are part of the Best Classroom Project, a group of parents who meet every month to organize daytime school visits and share information about what they find. The Best Classroom Project is made up of largely middle-class, professional Detroit families like the Hills who would like to send their kids to schools in the city. there's a sense that if more Detroit parents with means join forces and send their kids to a handful of city schools, they can start to build positive momentum. But the Hills admit that's tricky, trying to build diverse, innovative school communities without making your kids part of a social experiment. Jason Hill says Detroit parents need groups like the Best Classroom Project, but they shouldn't.
Because you should be able to leave your home and walk your kid to the closest public school.
But that's just not the reality in Detroit. I'm Sarah Swick.
In fact, Detroit schools can sometimes feel like warring tribes competing for the same students. There's a lack of system-wide coordination connecting the schools to the larger community and to the kinds of social services that many kids in impoverished cities like Detroit desperately need. You know, what's lost in all the discussions about Detroit schools is this. Many of the same issues that led the city of Detroit into bankruptcy are the same issues that put the Detroit public school system in bad shape. Lower tax revenue, a decline in population, a lack of employment options for parents. Mayor Duggan says he plans to partner with schools. He knows something has to happen with the schools to keep families like the Hills and the Peoples in Detroit. The second problem, discouraging people from staying in Detroit or moving there, is crime. Mayor Mike Duggan is promising more officers and squad cars. He touts faster response times, although because it's understaffed and there are not enough squad cars, response times still don't compete well with other cities. As we mentioned before, among large cities, Detroit has the highest murder rate in the country. It has the highest violent crime rate. We could go over the statistics, show the improvements, outline the plan for a safer Detroit, but crime is about perception. Every time a violent crime hits the front page of the newspapers or is covered endlessly on television news, it merely confirms the suspicions of many outside the city. Detroit is dangerous. For those who live in Detroit, it's still a struggle. When you love the city, how can you calculate how much crime you're willing to tolerate? Well, in a moving essay, my colleague Sarah Hewlett expressed that dilemma as well as anyone who lives in the city.
If you don't control crime, people will leave.
My name is Kathy Marshall, and we are in North Rosedale Park, Detroit.
For 19 years, Marshall lived in a great big 1930s Tudor on a grand old boulevard. Every morning, she'd get up, meet a friend at 5:15, and they'd walk their dogs. One day in December, she's on one of these walks, and a car pulls up next to them.
A guy jumped out with a very large shotgun, and he pointed it right in between my eyes, just a few inches from my face, and threatened to kill me if I didn't give him my money.
Marshall tells him, "We don't have any money. We're out walking our dogs." That just seemed to make him mad. He started waving the gun around.
And he was threatening to kill the dogs, and he's threatening to kill us. And, you know, it was completely terrifying.
Marshall says she'd never thought about leaving the city before. She raised her three kids in Detroit, volunteered at just about every community event, coached soccer. But after the ordeal ended, another car pulled up and the guys took off, Marshall went across the street to her husband and hugged him.
And I just said, "Get me out of here. Get me out of Detroit right now."
Marshall put her house on the market that month and moved out February 1st. So here we are, a few months later.
I want the big sprinkler.
That holdup, it happened right around the corner from where I live, with my husband and our two little girls.
My name is Evelyn. My sister's name is Jane. No.
Just like Kathy Marshall, we love our neighborhood. We love the energy. We love the people. But we are struggling with whether to stay. When it comes to crime, there are two kinds of conversations Detroiters tend to have. There are the ones we have with people who don't understand why anyone would live in Detroit. In those conversations, I probably won't talk about our car that got stolen or the rock that got thrown through our dining room window. And then there are the conversations we have at our dining room tables with our neighbors and our families. In my case, with my husband, Brian.
What's the first thing that goes through your mind when something bad happens, when crime happens close to us?
That I'm crazy for living here with my family. And I wonder, what am I doing? I need to do something about it. I need to move before something happens. Because if I don't, and something happens, I I don't know how I could live with that.
Right. When you live in a city, you accept that there will be crime. But whether you feel safe depends a lot on whether you've been robbed or assaulted, or you know someone who has. People stay in Detroit for a lot of reasons. Some people can't leave. Others might feel like we do. We want our girls to grow up with a sense of responsibility to their community, to raise them to believe that you don't just leave because things aren't perfect or easy.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Taxes are high in Detroit. It has the highest income tax, the highest real estate taxes, a utility tax. Yet for all those tax dollars, city services are not what they should be, not by a long shot. Under the emergency manager and Mayor Mike Duggan, some things have improved, some dramatically. For example, the emergency manager eliminated city-operated garbage pickup and turned it over to private companies. Garbage pickup is more regular. Because of the private sector donations, more EMTs are being hired and ambulance service is improving. More than 20,000 streetlights have been replaced, and streets that were in the dark for years are once again lit. I caught up with one of the several crews installing streetlights in neighborhoods around Detroit. James Englund is the foreman of this crew installing streetlights in the neighborhoods.
10 to 12 lights a day, actually, is what we're doing. We got to run new wire to the backyard into the easement, climb up the pole and run the wire back out here to the new pole and everything, and then put a new light mask, and everybody's loving it.
Altogether, the crews sometimes are installing close to 1,000 streetlights in a week, way more than the 500 a week the mayor first demanded. The electric cost for these LED streetlights is about 60% less because they're brighter and more efficient. Overall, costs will drop from $28 million a year to $5 million a year to light the streets. If the Public Lighting Authority of Detroit stays on track, all the neighborhoods will be lit by the end of next year. All the thoroughfares will have new streetlights by the end of 2016. Another issue that needs major improvement is public transportation. One out of every three Detroit households doesn't have a car. They rely on the bus system, but the bus system is broken. At the main garage of the Detroit Department of Transportation headquarters, they're working to get more buses on the road. Detroit needs something close to 270 buses to properly serve its 100,000 passengers a day. The city only has 228 buses, and a lot of them are broken down. In early summer, Detroit Department of Transportation Director Dan Dirks said each day more than 200 buses were out on the routes. That was an improvement from the few months earlier when they were only pulling about 160 out. Since then, the bus system has lost ground. A spokesman for the mayor's office now tells me the average is about 176 buses a day. Now, Detroit will be getting 50 new buses in January, but those new buses will merely replace old buses, not add to the size of the fleet. That will still mean more buses on the road, though, because so many of the buses in the city's aging fleet have mechanical problems. George Robinson is a mechanic at DDOT. He says the streets of Detroit are tough on the vehicles.
Can you imagine buses running 24/7 most of the time and high maintenance? You got a bus 10 years old, 9 years old. The older it is, the more work it takes to keep it on the road.
New buses will start hitting the streets at a rate of about 2 a week right after the first of the year. The city will continue to hire and train more drivers. A class of 20 students will be ready for the road beginning in January. As we mentioned before, Detroit firefighters battle more fires than a city the size of New York. The crews are using broken equipment. They're understaffed. Many of the firehouses are old. Some are too small to accommodate the engines and ladder trucks. Mayor Duggan promises more firefighters will be hired, and some of the infrastructure money will be used to buy new equipment. But the biggest problem they face is vacant building fires. The city is working on that end of the problem, too. Every Detroit mayor for decades has talked about blight. There have been plans and efforts to demolish burned-out houses, tear down crumbling buildings, and selling vacant lots to next-door neighbors. But the pace of demolition has not kept up with the number of people walking away from properties. Until recently, no one had a really good handle on how big the problem was or how much money it would take to clean up the mess. That changed when the Detroit Blight Elimination Task Force, working with the mayor, issued a major report. One of the co-chairs is Quicken Loans founder Dan Gilbert.
So when you add it all together, 30% of all the structures
structures in the city of Detroit, this has nothing to do with vacant land, are blighted, or 78,500 of them.
Gilbert explained just to tear down the houses and small apartments that are beyond saving would cost $850 million. That's a lot of cash. But a combination of federal money, private donations, fire escrow funds, and the money set aside in the city's bankruptcy agreement all add up.
We've already got $456 million of the $850 million we need.
But that's just for the houses in the neighborhoods. It'll cost more than $1 billion on top of that $850 million to tear down the larger abandoned commercial and industrial buildings. Under Mayor Duggan, demolition crews increased the number of teardowns from about 150 a month to hundreds a month.
They've identified the worst of the houses, and they're demoing. It'll be up to 800 a month.
And the city is selling houses to people willing to fix them up and to make sure that they're occupied. It's also giving neighbors the opportunity to buy vacant lots next to them for $100. But there are still a lot of obstacles ahead for the mayor and the city. In recent years, fewer than half of Detroit's residents paid their property taxes. 62,000 Detroit properties are headed for the auction block next year if owners don't pay their taxes. Now, some will, but many won't, and that means more tax foreclosures, less in property tax revenue, and more houses to sell or demolish in the future. Coming up, a look at jobs for a city where the unemployment rate is double that of the state average, as Stateside continues to examine Detroit post-bankruptcy. This is a special edition of Stateside looking at Detroit post-bankruptcy. I'm Lester Graham. Sitting down in her living room and listening to Yolanda People's family talk about what's happened to their neighborhood, their Detroit, gives you the sense that people are frustrated with the things beyond a typical citizen's control. None of the family members liked it when Governor Rick Snyder appointed an emergency manager for the city. That stripped authority from the elected mayor and the elected city council. At the same time, the family is appalled that so few people in Detroit vote. Sometimes voter turnout is as low as 18%. And then they have elected people such as the disgraced Kwame Kilpatrick. Yolanda's father, LaVon Peoples, did not like having an emergency manager, but...
Well, they did need somebody to get the things under control because they were stealing too much.
Now that the current mayor and elected city council are running things again, he's worried about whether Detroit political leaders might be too cozy with the big money crowd.
Most of the big corporations, they got them in their pockets anyway. They got to do what they want them to do.
The People's family watches billionaire Dan Gilbert, the founder of Quicken Loans, buys building after building in downtown. They watched as the Illich family got a tax-subsidized deal to build a new hockey arena and development surrounding it. Yolanda Peoples is concerned that kind of Detroit renaissance will leave the people of Detroit behind.
The Illiches, the Gilberts, they don't want us to prosper. They don't want us to grow. They don't want us to have our own because then it takes away from their investment, from their growth.
This idea is not that uncommon. There's a belief that there's some kind of conspiracy in Detroit to keep the people down. It's part of a growing unrest about income inequality all across the nation, but it's amplified in Detroit because so many people once had good-paying jobs in a city that worked for a living. Now those jobs are scarce, and Detroit has been in steep decline. Detroit has been hit hard, and most people don't see things getting better.
It will never be a situation that will benefit the masses here, because it doesn't benefit the 1% that's getting it now. That's not part of their plan. It's not part of their vision. And they're the ones with the money, so they're the ones with the control and the power.
You're listening to a special edition of Stateside looking at Detroit post-bankruptcy. I'm Lester Graham sitting in for Cynthia Canty. We've been hearing the perspectives of Yolanda People's family today, her parents and her children, and we wanted to get an idea if their feelings are widely felt in Detroit neighborhoods. Joining us is Detroit blogger, writer Aaron Foley. So the People's family is skeptical about how much of the ballyhoo about development in downtown and along the Cass Corridor or Midtown. They feel there's a disconnect between what's happening there and what's happening in their neighborhoods. How common is that feeling?
I think it's pretty common. And I think the reason why that is because when a lot of the movers and shakers do come to Detroit, it's just been downtown, midtown, Corktown, Woodbridge, you know, those core areas there.
So one of the things that we've been seeing with this new mayor, Mike Duggan, is he's been talking about the neighborhoods a lot, how we have to reach out to the neighborhoods. He's working on this with the Public Lighting Authority, putting the streetlights up. The emergency manager got garbage pickup fairly well straightened up. So we are talking about some services that actually get to the neighborhoods, but at the same time, there's a lot of concern that there's no blight cleanup in my neighborhood. What are you talking about? Or there's no streetlights in my neighborhood yet. What are you talking about? Vast areas of the city that still are in the same place they were 5 years ago, 7 years ago.
I think it's really important that Mayor Duggan does talk about the neighborhoods. No, there's no better person to say, hey, please pay attention to other areas, the whole city, than the guy in charge. But I would agree. I think it's a mixture of having to be patient. Detroit is still very large. It's 139 square miles. Resources are still thin. But it's now becoming a question of how long can people wait.
The Detroit unemployment rate is still nearly double that of the state average. Some jobs are being created here and there. But there's not nearly enough jobs fast enough to get the city out of poverty. What can be done about that? What should the politicians be thinking about when it comes to employment, jobs, economy in the city?
I have talked to people who are working on this. The city needs to make it easier for businesses, large and small, to do business here, getting rid of some of the red tape that involves, you know, just getting permits to open a business, just getting licensing to opening a business. That's something a lot of business owners face. Just making it easier to do business here. And I think the city and the state should be working together to consider, okay, Detroit has a lot of empty manufacturing facilities, for example. What businesses can we bring here to put those to good use? If there's a lot of empty land, what can be built upon this land possibly to get people back to work? There's a lot of legal things that have to be addressed for more jobs to come here. And of course, you know, opening the door, letting people know that Detroit is open for business.
Are there enough opportunities for the labor force, which is largely unskilled, to get the kind of training they need for 21st century jobs?
I don't think so at the moment. I think what some suggestions could be done is working with perhaps some of the community colleges or some of the smaller colleges here in the area to sort of expand some of those programs to get people up and running again. But no, I don't think there's enough opportunity. I look at people on my street, on my block, you know, who they can build a house, they can tear something down, but finding a steady job with benefits, they can't find it.
So you're a citizen of the city of Detroit. If you got a chance to sit down with Mayor Duggan, the president of the city council, and the governor, what would you stress to them needs to be a priority for Detroit?
Addressing unemployment, getting people steady, stable work. Like I said, there's a lot of people just getting by on odd jobs. You know, there's a guy on my street who he rakes people's leaves, he paints people's walls, he fixes people's roofs, and yet he's getting by on SSI pretty much. Getting stable jobs so that, you know, he's an older guy. We have a new generation coming in that's getting older. They need to be working in stable positions.
That's Aaron Foley. He's a blogger, writer, and journalist, and a resident of the city of Detroit. Thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Lester.
Jobs are critical for a Detroit turnaround. Yes, Detroit has to find ways to cut spending and increase revenue, but that's not going to be so easy when so many Detroit residents are struggling just to get by. The city is going nowhere if most of its residents are broke and without jobs. No jobs means no income taxes for the city. Income taxes amount to the largest category of taxes collected, close to $4 out of $10 collected. So Detroit needs that money to keep the streetlights on and keep the trash picked up. That's why companies coming to Detroit and hiring residents of Detroit is an exciting trend for Detroit boosters. Earlier this year, I was allowed on the assembly floor of a Detroit company called Shinola. It makes, among other things, as you probably know, watches. Shinola has added nearly 100 jobs since I last visited. About 320 technicians work there now. Shinola is assembling its watches in Detroit as part of a statement. Watches from the gritty urban underdog sell pretty well in the upscale New York, L.A., D.C., London, and dozens of other stores around the world. Jacques Panisse is Shinola's president. He says there's another reason to build watches in Detroit.
Manufacturing is in the DNA of the people in this city. And we're manufacturing watches here, much like cars and car engines. You know, we have an assembly facility right here in Midtown Detroit.
He added, if you like the city and you want the city to succeed, you've got to make sure the people succeed.
You know, it's all from people right here in the city who are living here in the city, who are part of this inner city community, who are renting homes, buying homes.
3 out of 4 people who work at Shinola live in Detroit. They're buying those houses, they're paying those property taxes, they pay the city's income tax. Reynolds Farley is a professor at the University of Michigan. He says besides a lot of people abandoning Detroit in the last few decades, those who are left don't have the kinds of jobs they used to have if they have a job at all.
One of the more discouraging things with regard to the black population is in 1970, the typical job was in vehicle manufacturing. Now, the largest employers of African Americans in the state of Michigan are the quick food restaurants.
That's left those residents still living in Detroit with very little.
And so the income of black families is down. The wages of black men are about half in real terms now what they were in 1970, and the poverty rate has gone up.
Jobs are still scarce in the city, as we've said, but of adult black men aged 25 to 59, you'll only find about 45% have jobs. So when a company comes to Detroit and makes a determined effort to hire people from Detroit, it matters. Another company, a company called Detroit Manufacturing Systems, which makes dashboards for Ford vehicles, has also hired hundreds of Detroit residents in the last few years. Of the more than 800 hired, 2/3 of those workers live in Detroit. The company plans to hire another 200 people because of Ford's new aluminum-bodied F-150 truck. Pamela Moore heads up the nonprofit Detroit Employment Solutions Corporation. She says her group, which used to be a City of Detroit agency, has changed its approach. It used to be someone without a job would come in, tell the agency what vocation they wanted to pursue, and that person would get the training they needed for that job. Problem was, often there weren't always a lot of jobs in that field. That approach earned the nickname Train and Pray. But these days, the Detroit Employment Solutions takes a different approach.
Now it's a demand-driven system. We look to the employer to tell us what the demand is, the kinds of skills that they're looking for, and that is how we determine how to use our resources.
So Detroit Employment Solutions Corporation screens potential workers, tests them for literacy, manual dexterity, and whatever else the employer might need. Moore says Detroit Manufacturing Systems has been its biggest success story.
And the Detroit Manufacturing Systems relationship has resulted in a 2-to-1 recruitment to hire ratio. So every 2 people that we send, they hire 1, and that's an incredible ratio.
At Detroit Manufacturing Systems, Rosemary Brewer says on average its workers had been unemployed for 18 months before they hired in here. It didn't make sense to ignore a talent pool right in Detroit.
You want people that are from the area to say, I'm just as valuable and viable to work as the next person. If I don't have the means to get out to the suburbs, should I be denied an opportunity to have a good paying job?
It's a union shop. Pay starts at $11 an hour and each year goes up $1 an hour. There's health insurance, a retirement plan, and there's tuition assistance. $5,200 a year for any kind of schooling a worker chooses. On the floor, workers are building instrument panels for Ford's Mustang, the F-150 truck, the Explorer, the Expedition, the Taurus, and the Focus. Richard Harris says getting a job at a manufacturing plant in Detroit means something.
Nationally, Detroit is not really held in, I feel like, high regard, but I think this gives us a chance to show what the people of Detroit are really made of.
And with the unemployment rate at more than 14%, workers such as Damon Thomas are just grateful.
It's good to know that somebody is willing to give us another chance. You know, the other generations, they were able to come into Ford and come in, you know, manufacturing and everything. But to be chosen to be accepted and to be able to come into this company like that. It was an honor to me.
Detroit Manufacturing Systems has been steadily growing since it started during the summer of 2012. The Detroit Employment Solutions Corporation says there are plenty of other people in Detroit ready to work if they get the chance. Detroit's mayor, Mike Duggan, knows more jobs for Detroit residents is key to keeping the city together, improving city services, and making the city more attractive. The people in the city are beginning to notice more regular garbage pickup, more streetlights turning on, and more blight removal.
Just in the short amount of time he had, he done did a lot. Can't even put nothing past Mike Duggan. You know, that's like the best man ever, man, you know, as far as mayor.
Everything improved. He doing his job, put it that way.
Duggan, man!
You're a fan of the mayor, then?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
So Duggan's a pretty popular guy, and personal style is another reason Duggan is popular. He often dresses casually, he drives himself around the neighborhoods, he stops and he talks with residents. But in the end, it will all come down to whether residents continue to believe the mayor is bringing the city back. And Stephen Henderson, the editor of the editorial page at the Free Press, says people are not going to be patient forever. It's going to take some time to get all the streetlights turned on and the buses regularly running on time and getting tens of thousands of blighted buildings torn down.
I think it's very frustrating, though, for people who live here. Everybody figures everything's going to get fixed in a short window of time, and that's just not very realistic.
Mayor Duggan says it comes down to this. He wants people to judge him on the job and his administration on one thing, whether people stop moving out of Detroit.
And we focus on what we can do to reverse the population decline in the city of Detroit. It governs every single decision we make. We do not have a future if we don't start growing.
At the Detroit News, the editorial page editor there, Nolan Finley, says that's not a bad measure.
Because if people stop leaving, it suggests they have a higher level of satisfaction with the way the city is operating or a greater faith in its future to solve its problems. Those are good benchmarks. If he can hit them, you know, he's done enough in his first term.
So it's about attracting people. And the developments in Detroit's central business districts are attracting people to those areas. But what about existing residents? Will that resurgence in downtown and in Midtown have a ripple effect that touches and improves the lives in the neighborhoods across the city? Eric Lufer is the president of Citizens Research Council of Michigan. It's a public policy research group that's been around for nearly 100 years. Lufer says it's the pattern of the resurgent cities to see a booming of interest in the central business districts. But for Detroit, he thinks there's a ticking clock. Downtown's renaissance needs to blossom into jobs for people across the city, making the whole city prosperous, not just those young, adventurous entrepreneurs who are moving in right now.
Because these are young people who will soon be starting young families, and when those young families have kids that are 4 and 5 years old, they start looking for schools and asking, is my kid going to be safe in the school they're going to, and are they going to get a quality education? The school systems, whether it's charter schools, schools of choice, or Detroit public schools, needs to get better quickly to be able to meet that need.
So we're kind of back at the schools. Mayor Duggan has no control over how the schools operate right now, but there's been some talk about giving him some kind of role. He's already proven he's willing to work with Governor Rick Snyder, and Snyder is bringing in outside help to deal with the school situation in Detroit. It's possible that new approach could include Mayor Duggan. It's not too hard to be optimistic about Detroit, considering bankruptcy was settled quickly and the mayor has shown he's going to make things happen. Duggan, along with Governor Snyder and his apparent willingness to pay attention to Detroit in a way recent governors have not, could be a formidable duo. While both insist they are working to improve the lives of the average Detroit resident, how long will it take, and will it primarily be through the efforts in the central business districts, hoping for a ripple effect, a sort of trickle-out economic benefit, if you will? Or will we find them in the neighborhoods, reaching out for partnerships with people of Detroit who've already suffered the most through the city's decades of decline? Stateside executive producer is Zoe Clark. This special report was edited by Sarah Hewlett. Additional reporting came from Sarah Swick and Sarah Hewlett. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, and the Ford Foundation. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.